And welcome to another episode of Pit Lane Parlay. This is Matt Hickey with host Mike. How you doing?
I'm lovely. How are you?
I am, well, better now that the Indy 500's over with. I'm also sad, obviously.
Yeah.
But better because it was such a good race. Oh, my goodness. For those of you who live under a rock, the top five from the race was Elio Castroneves, Meyer Shank Racing, first place, fourth Indy 500 win for Elio, the first one-off to do it since Dan Weld in 2011. So much to go through. We'll try to get into as much as we can. Alex Palou second, Simon Pagenaud, an epic comeback to P3, Pat O'Ward, P4, and Ed Carpenter, also a really good noteworthy. They come back to P5. We're just going to start with Elio. It was so refreshing to see him celebrate. And I know in the past, and I will still maintain why, and we'll talk about it here in a second. You know, I'm not known as the biggest Elio fan. However, it's
You're
still
not.
No, I know. But it's still, it was still awesome to see him celebrate in the way he did. And obviously the fence climb was going to happen, but then to continue it and to celebrate the fans and go up to the fence several times and run down the straight and the lap in the pace car afterwards with the owners and Doug Bowles where the fans were climbing the fence was so cool. That's an image that's going to stick around for a long time. Just all of the scenes after the race is why people love Elio Castroneves and why the Speedway and him will always be intertwined. So he's won his fourth one now. He now joins Unser, Foyt, and Mears as the four-time winners. Doesn't sound like he's going to step away anytime soon. So now every year we'll get the five-time question mark. Where do you rank him at this point, even though he's still got some years left? Where do you rank him among the all-time greats at the Indianapolis 500?
Wow. If I knew I was going to be brought with such a question, I would have done a little bit more research, but definitely top five. I mean, the fact you're a four-time winner automatically puts you above, say, a Michael Andretti who led, you know, 4,000 laps there and didn't manage to win a race. But I don't know where I would put him, say. It's tough to, I really struggle comparing somebody like Elio with AJ Foyt or, you know, Bobby Unser or Al Unser or anything like that, just because it was such a different era of racing. So I am going to say he is top five all time at the Speedway and just leave it at that.
Yeah. For me, my brain is pretty black and white and there is nothing to take away from the drivers of yesteryear because I think it takes a different kind of driver to drive. I mean, we're obviously for the longest time racing was ridiculously unsafe. I'm talking like 1911 when the first Indy 500 started to about the 60s and 70s, like just
mid 60s,
horrendous,
at least.
Horrendously unsafe. Like you guys are absolutely nuts for taking that car onto the track and trying to race it. Like you have lost your mind. And then from there it became pretty darn unsafe and fast and this new wave of technology and teams really ramping it up. And then we get to the 90s and on, and now it's specifically 96, you know, spec series, very few chassis. Engines are pretty marginally the same for the most part. And when I factor that into my brain, you know, Foyt, Unser, Mears, Clark, De Palma, whoever, nothing taken away from those guys. But I now would absolutely rank Elio as the greatest Indy 500 driver of all time. To win four races in a spec series era, I struggle to see that happening maybe ever again. I mean, one could make the argument that when they showed up in 01, you know, Penske was better than everybody. But we have to remember they only ran like three IRL races before that, or maybe even two. I think it might have been two IRL races before they showed up to that first one. And they still wiped the floor with the IRL field. And he was also a rookie that year. First time doing the Indy 500. I loved his subtle shade of Paul Tracy in this thing. That was awesome. But whatever you think the finish happened, he still ran a great race. 09 had the comeback story because of his legal troubles. And then between then and now, he's had 3 second place finishes. 2017, coulda, shoulda, woulda with, I think it was 2016, the year that Hildebrand hit his rear pod. And he said some not so nice things about Hildebrand on the radio. But that really, obviously, he was running like top five all day. He just doesn't do anything poorly at the Speedway for some reason. He's just always there. It's insane. And now to do this in Dragon Speed's chassis from last year on a team that's been running full time for two seasons. Yes, they have a lot of help from Andretti Autosport, but that's still for us. A team that's been doing this for two seasons to come up with a part-time entry for Elio to field it. First race with the team, and he goes out and wins. It's like Hollywood stuff almost. So, I don't know. I just think that looking at what he's done, I have to say that he's the best to ever do it at Indy 500. The only other one I would take is probably Rick Mears. But, you know, you look at some of his wins, And Penske was far and away better than some of the teams that he ran against in some of those seasons. Credit, he does have to go out there and beat his teammates who are all also elite. But just looking at the strength of the field nowadays with how many good teams are there, you could have had 25 different drivers win on Sunday. So for Elio to win it again was like, what on earth is happening here?
Yeah, I can't argue with anything you said, especially you're just looking at the leader summary from this weekend. Obviously, you know, Connor Daly was super strong for a while. Second place, Pelot was strong for a while. VK was strong. Pato was strong. Colton Herta was strong. Graham Rahal was strong. Scott Dixon started strong. Simon Pagenaud was flying through the field. There were so many things that could have happened, and as Simon Pagenaud said on the post-race media call, he said he could see what Elio was doing for essentially the last 25-ish laps, where he was just learning what Pelot was doing and just waiting for the right time to make that pass. So, yeah, you might have swayed my decision a little bit, and we will have a special episode this week with Elio. We were able to get on the media list for the 500 winner, which is a huge honor and super difficult to do. And we haven't been on that list yet in our 4 years as we've continued to grow, but I will be on it with like a handful of other media guys. So it won't be just me, and it'll be during the day, so Matt won't be joining, but still a really cool honor to talk to him, and I'm excited. But Matt, where do we want to start? Let's start with the first pit stop issue. Stephen Wilson loses his brakes going into the pits. Okay, brings out a yellow flag. You think, all right, no harm, no foul. I mean, harm for Stephen, but the rest of the field just packs back up. Oh, wait, half the field has to go into emergency mode and pit during a closed pit stop. We have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 cars who had to restart at the back of the field. And then actually 10 total, 8 total because of pitting under a closed pit. Will Power failed to keep pace car speed, and Chilton had a pit speed violation. Is that the most hectic penalty sequence under a yellow flag you can remember? Because it does make sense why it took so long under yellow once you kind of look at the fact there were 10 penalties to sort through.
Yeah, I'm glad we didn't get more cautions, because that one, first one, was pretty painful.
Yeah, it was.
As far as Wilson's incident, we saw what, 6-7 other drivers do the exact same thing. So I don't think it was a driver issue. I think it was just the conditions and drivers pushing the limit and whatnot. So I think there's some people are pretty unfair to Stefan on Twitter. It wasn't great to see, but I hope he gets a chance to come back and do it again. And then, yeah, I said this on Twitter. I really don't. I mean, I'm not saying that you need to go 100% and go full out like Colton and Renus were doing, but I really don't understand the point of saving fuel on the first stint of what's going to be about a 2.5 hour race. I mean, it would make sense if you think I think it was 2014 where there wasn't a yellow until like lap 160.
Yeah.
And if you're really banking on that, then yeah, I think it would make sense to do that. Or if you really think there's not going to be a single caution in the race, yeah, trying to ink out one less pit stop would probably be a really good idea. But not knowing it just didn't really make a whole lot of sense. Or you could just maybe do like the first stint normal and maybe the second stint normal. And you're like, oh, wow, like conditions are great. Grip is really good. No one's crashing. Like maybe let's start to, you know, trim it out and dial back the fuel. I just don't understand why it's worth pushing it on the first stint. And, you know, it's the first hot stop of the day. Drivers are going to make mistakes here and there, or miss the wrong pit stop, or crews are under pressure. You're going to send a guy out who has a really good strategy and his wheel's not going to be on it correctly. Not bitter about that because I picked him in fantasy. It's fine. But I just don't understand it. So to see Rossi, Dixon, Kanaan, Erickson, et cetera, all get screwed because they stayed out too long in that first one, it just boggles my mind, really. And their whole race is basically over at that point on lap 39.
Yeah, you bring up a great point. Early on in the race, you really need to see how it plays out. You know, you have strategy A, okay, fuel safe. Strategy B, go hard. I just don't think it makes sense to wait and wait and wait. Because if you're a guy like Rossi, you're starting in 10th. Okay, you want to jump up top 5, top 6, then maybe hang out. But you don't want to go into ultra safe mode because, well, then when lap 35 comes around, you stall in pit lane and Rossi never recovered. Dixon looked like he was about to recover, but just didn't have the sequence quite down in terms of when his last pit stop was. But I definitely agree there. I also feel bad for Stefan. It wasn't his fault. I did not see anything on social media, but I haven't particularly been on much over the last 24 and change hours. So shame on anybody who blamed Stefan for that. But I am very curious to see, because, you know, so it happened to him, happened to Will Power, happened to Simona, happened to Hunter Ray, McLaughlin. I might be missing one. I think that's it.
About right.
Felix Rosenqvist had a speeding penalty in pit lane. But I don't think that was... Yeah.
I think they said a half a mile over, so so yeah. Close.
But so I'm curious as to, you know, every driver said the brake pedal went to the floor. So I'm curious as to what the technical reason behind this was. And I know, so as of Tuesday night, it hasn't come out yet. I know Marshall Pruitt said he was working on something, talking to teams and talking to the brake manufacturer and Dallara and whatnot. So I am very curious to understand that. I would like to understand kind of technically what happened there that maybe drivers could do better, or it would not do better. That's putting the blame on the drivers, at least what they could have learned from it.
Yeah. I mean, when it happens so many times, like I said, it's just kind of it's not a driver issue, I don't think. So curious to see what comes out there. So, I wanted to point out one thing too, is that it's crazy that there was not a single on-track incident, despite what I perceived to be the craziest start of an Indy 500 ever coming to the line. Cause it looked like Talladega almost, with, you know, 3x3, 8 rows deep. We had one row that was 4 wide somehow. McLaughlin really got a good start and just decided to go on the outside. So that was crazy. I'm really glad we got through that. I was, so nervous on the couch watching that. I'm like, oh my God, that looks terrible. And if one person gets that wrong, that's a 15 to 20 car crash immediately, which is would be such a bad look for the sport. So I'm really glad they got through that okay. And then, yeah, there was, not to my knowledge, there was not a single on-track contact all day, which was really well done by the field. The only crash, I mean, obviously other than Wilson in the pits, was Ray Hall getting sent out on a tire that wasn't fitted properly, and then he crashed into the turn two wall. Really glad he didn't spin into the path of anybody, because that could have been really nasty. So, and then, you know, the tire bouncing, thankfully, we have the aero screen as a backup now, but it did hit Connor Daly's front wing. But if we didn't have the aero screen, that would have been a very scary near miss, really. So that was, again, just thankful for the safety there. But kind of pivoting back to Ray Hall here, he said in his interview that they were the ones to beat. He was another one that was saving a lot of fuel and doing the overcut really well. I think he was about to cycle somewhere into the fifth region, but he really insisted that he was going to win that race. So are you buying or selling what Ray Hall was saying in that interview there?
Oh, definitely buying. I don't know if it was his first stint. I think it might have been his second stint. He went 6 or 7 laps longer than anybody else, and his last few laps on that stint were competitive lap times to the leaders at the time. So I think he was definitely a force to be reckoned with. And obviously, again, to no fault of his own, I'd have to go back and look at it, but it almost looked like to me the team hadn't yet sent him out when he went, because they knew there was a problem with that lug nut. So I don't know. I'd have to watch it. I think this would be the fourth time. I watched the replay of the 500 that night, and I watched the replay again on Monday, because it's done nothing but rain here for like 4 days. So, and that was the one thing I did not look at a second and third time, because I just couldn't bring myself to feel bad for Ray Hall again. I am curious. I did hear that at some point, it might have been early on, Montoya made a little bit of contact with Sage Karam. I think I saw on social media Karam mentioned that. So pretty impressive then that they both finished in 7th for Karam and 9th for Montoya. So, you know, you mentioned Elio winning as a one-off, which hasn't happened since Dan Weldon, but we have one-offs kind of littered all throughout the top 10 and top 15, really, and Ferrucci in 6th, Karam in 7th, Montoya in 9th. Let's go down here. Hildebrand in 15th. So, and obviously Elio winning the race. So I can't remember a year where, okay, obviously, you know, you have a one-off that's strong occasionally. I can't, like, this is kind of like the year of the one-off where they're so strong throughout the top 15, really.
Yeah, I don't know what it is with Ferrucci. It's, I mean, I'm not going to compare him to Munoz, but he kind of has that Munoz feel to him where dude is really good at Indy. And then kind of everywhere else you go, oh, he's okay. Like, he's had a couple good moments at like Gateway and whatnot. But really, if you think about it, it's kind of just Indianapolis is like his thing. So I'm trying to think of a year where we had as many good one-offs. The only one that really came to my mind from the last couple of years, at least off the top of my head, was 2013, almost solely because Carlos Munoz finished 2nd in his first career start. AJ Allmendinger in his one and only Indy 500, in my opinion, had the strongest car that day. He ended up finishing 7th, but I think that doesn't quite show just how good he was that day. So those are two really good part-timers that year. Kind of looking at other drivers here on that list, not really. Connor Daly didn't do a whole lot that day. Catherine Legg, no. Townsend Bell, no. So, yeah, I mean, to see Montoya do well after kind of a tough GP, to see Ferrucci continue what we all kind of perceive of him as far as being a really good driver at the Indy 500, and and he did not pass Connor Daly on the first lap. Just want that noted for the record. And then obviously Elio winning. That's a, I know he had 35 cars this year, almost 36. I think you can maybe see the point in case or maybe having more part-time entries next year. I think if you're a team and don't look at the results this year and go, wow, we should do this. Or even Andretti, we like to make fun of them for having 8 cars. Well, one of them won, and it wasn't the one we really pegged to win, but that they won. And Harvey had a good race too. He just didn't had another terrible pit stop apparently, which really sucks. But, you know, I think hopefully some of the teams that maybe didn't take advantage of this opportunity to add another entry this year, maybe look at it again and go, maybe there's something here to this.
I think kind of adding on what you said, yeah, I feel bad for Jack Harvey, just can't catch a break. But maybe this also helps sponsors go, oh, all these one-off entries are doing well, which leads me to think, oh, I should spend some marketing money on an Indy 500 entry because there is more of a chance where versus kind of the last couple of years, the one-offs have been not featured up high outside of, you know, Karam had a good run with the Whips Filters car a few years ago. But yeah, I know you have one more thing to say before we move on. I have one other topic to get to before we talk about our dismal predictions.
Sounds good. I just think it's funny that when you say the marketing thing, because this car, every car that wins the Indy 500 obviously is going to be immortalized and preserved and whatnot. And they're going to make replicas of it, things like that. But it said, what does it say on the car? Something like free Sirius XM until June 14th. We're going to be looking at that like 30 years from now going like, what the heck is that about? Are they going to have to offer free Sirius through like June, whatever, for the rest of ever?
I forget who it was. Somebody was like, I can't figure out how to take a picture of the QR code on my TV right now to get the free Sirius. And I didn't comment because I didn't want to upset the youths on Twitter during the race. But all you have to do, like most TVs have like the pause button now if you have cable. Or I guess if you even have, if you're watching it on, you know, YouTube TV or whatever, you can just hit the pause button and then you can scan the QR code. Just saying, it's not that hard. Anyway, with Ferrucci's sixth place result, Takuma Sato finished 14th after starting 15th, kind of really outside of leading 7 laps, which I think was the result of just timing of pit stops, and Ray Hall obviously crashing but having a really strong car. I want to say Ray Hall, Letterman, Lanigan has now cemented themselves in, you know, a team that should be considered an Indy 500 winning contention car every year. Yay or nay?
Nay. Okay. I would say
right below it.
No, I'd say I think the last couple of years for sure. It just obviously depends on, honestly, it depends on Team Penske getting their act together. I don't know what's going on there, but it seems like the last 2 years with the introduction of the aero screen, yes, they've looked very good, but I think that's kind of subject to ebb and flow a little bit depending on what changes from year to year. And, you know, if someone poaches some of their staff, things like that. So I was very hopeful on their chances this year. I actually picked all three of their drivers in fantasy. I don't know what happened to Sato, if I'm being honest. I think they just got the strategy wrong. But he was, to my memory, running kind of lower top 10 before they threw the dice. So, I mean, they were just going for the win. Hard to fault them. But I just don't think it worked out to quite what they were hoping for. But yeah, I struggle to put anybody, even Ganassi. I mean, Ganassi could lay an egg next year. I mean, they looked really strong this year, but who knows what changes between year to year. And as strong as they were all month, they didn't even get the win. So, no, I think going into next year, it's still kind of one of those things. I have no idea who's going to be good.
Fair enough.
I got one for you. And I know you're talking to Elio. I would love you forever if you told him that I thought he was the GOAT at Indy. I feel like for me, this is something I don't normally admit about people. especially Elio, someone who I've been very critical of in the past. So I got a couple Elio questions for you. The first is, do you think, and I think this might be on the slate to, that someone's going to ask him, but do you think Meyer Shank alter his rest of season schedule now that they have this enormous purse that they've just won and the exposure and the fame and all that? Do we see Elio going from a six schedule outing to maybe more?
It's definitely possible. I know Michael Shank said that before he does any road and street courses, he would likely get a test day in at some point. I don't know if it was this, it's now June, yeah, so this month or early July, but I don't think it would be anything before, say, whatever is after Mid-Ohio. So I know there's like the Olympic break this summer, so maybe like the end of July or early August, whatever that first. So I guess Nashville, I don't know. I just don't know timing-wise if this year would work out. Do I think it would help, and I might be stealing your thunder for your next question, for him to be like a second full-time Meyer Shank car next year? I would see that as a, I could see him doing like 10 races next year. Like, I don't know about full-time, but I think the exposure will definitely help more next year.
Yeah, I get excited at the possibility of just maybe this turning into something better, just because I'm always excited to add another,
yeah,
what appears to be good quality entry and, you know, an obvious legend of the sport and whatnot. Someone who has a lot of fans and can, you know, really help with, you know, fan engagement and whatnot at the track.
Yeah, especially if fans are going to be allowed in the paddock over the next couple races, I think starting at least Detroit and Road America have confirmed that. But I could see him doing Gateway now that I kind of think on it a little bit. That would be one that would be relatively, I don't want to say easy for them to add, but it's an oval, so he wouldn't need as much. And I'm sure he's run there in past IndyCar experiences at some point years ago. So, and did he do one with Penske before he got shuttered to IMSA, or did that timing wise just not match up?
Hey there, and welcome to the Joy of Paddle podcast, hosted by me, Minter Dial, a veteran of the paddle tennis world, and sponsored by Paddle 1969. Whether you're a paddle tennis aficionado, just beginning, or have never even heard of paddle, or padel, as it's called in North America, this is an exhilarating new show that delves into the captivating stories of notable paddle personalities worldwide. In its inaugural season, you'll be treated to exclusive anecdotes, valuable tips, life lessons, and humorous moments shared by esteemed professional paddle players, industry insiders, and passionate paddle enthusiasts. With each season aligning with the Pro Tour, you can anticipate two engaging episodes per month. The Joy of Paddle podcast is part of the Evergreen Podcast Network, where you can find other great shows in a number of categories, such as sports, health and wellness, true crime, and fiction. To find out more about Evergreen Podcasts, go to www.evergreenpodcast.com. Vamos!
Have you ever wanted to know how to win a Formula One Grand Prix? I mean, really know. Know about the driver tactics from the cockpit, the strategy calls from the pit wall, and even the mind games in the paddock. There's a lot more that goes into winning a Grand Prix than just 90 minutes of racing. So every week on the F1 Strategy Report, we're taking a deep dive into the decisions that shape every result. Hey there, my name is Michael Laminato, and every week I'm joined by an expert guest from the paddock to talk through the big calls that won the race and the missteps that resulted in bitter defeat. Before every race, we'll look back at the previous year's result and consult the current form guide, and we'll be in your feed after every Grand Prix dissecting the outcome and what it means for the championship. So for your regular hit of Formula One analysis, subscribe to the F1 Strategy Report wherever you get your favourite podcasts. The Strategy Report is a Beer Mogul podcast on the Evergreen Podcasts Network. My name's Michael Laminato, and I'll catch you after the checkered flag.
What do you mean? Just Indy or other races?
Gateway. Did he do Gateway, or was that, was Gateway back on the IndyCar calendar right after he got booted from Penske full time?
So Gateway was 2017 and he was still full time at that one, because I think that's okay. the one where he was. It's either that or Iowa, where he was doing super well and ran. I think it was Gateway. He ran out of fuel on the pit stop in and then stalled from like the top three or something.
Yep. I think I was there.
Yes. That was the only time he's run Gateway, I believe, because then he went down to part time, I think, in 2018, if memory serves me correct. So, so my second question was actually something that our buddy David Lighting brought up.
I can't wait Twitter. For this.
And if you happen to be one of the couple of individuals who ate lunch at the same restaurant with David Lighting and waved at him and said hi and said, hey, you're that guy that was on that podcast at one time, weren't you? That word did get back to us. So yes, David Lighting is more famous than us somehow, which doesn't surprise me. I mean, I'm not down on myself per se, but he is a little better looking than me for sure. So there's no shame there. So same. He definitely has a more famous face than I do. So, but yes, we appreciate the support and we're glad somehow one way or another, David Lighting is attached to this podcast in that way, I guess. I think that's his claim to fame apparently or something. I don't know. Anyways, something our good friend David Lighting brought up on social media was kind of the, which legacy would you rather have postulation? And he was trying to see if you were an individual who could, you know, start your racing career and then 20 years down the line, if you could pick your resume, would you pick 4 Indianapolis 500 wins and 0 IndyCar championships, or 6 IndyCar championships but only 1 Indianapolis 500 win? So which are you taking?
I love this. I knew this was going to be a question on the show. As soon as I saw, well, you and Lighting going back and forth kind of over the weekend a little bit, and then I don't know if it was today or yesterday on Twitter. So I have rehearsed my answer. I don't want to say rehearse, but I have thought about my answer enough to where I would say I would take 4 Indianapolis 500 victories over 1 and 6 championships.
Okay. Well, you obviously know I disagree.
Yes.
And this is part of where my bias against Elio comes in. So, and I'm just saying, I did just say like 20 minutes ago that I think he's the greatest Indianapolis 500 driver ever. And that's a lofty claim for me to make. I'm not sitting here and saying that's not outrageous. Maybe some people disagree. That's fine. It's only been a race that's been going around since 1911. So for someone to kind of boldly claim there's one driver amongst all of them that's better than everybody, it's kind of a bold claim. But as far as legacies go, what that means is that we're saying you would rather be the best driver of the greatest race of all time rather than just an all-around great driver. And so this is where I struggle with Elio. Again, he's on the, I think for definitively, he's on the Mount Rushmore at the very least of Indianapolis 500 drivers, wherever people may lay on that debate. But he is not an elite IndyCar driver all around. He's had too good of a ride for too long to not have won a championship with Team Penske. And I've always said that if he had won a championship at some point, he absolutely would be up near the top 10, top 5 of greatest IndyCar drivers ever. But without that championship, I just can't do it. I can't convince myself that he's one of the great drivers. And so on the flip side, if Scott Dixon had 6 IndyCar championships and no Indy 500 wins, I'd be like, well, that resume is incomplete. Like, you can do it everywhere, but how can you not get it done at the most important race in the world? So I would also say that one's incomplete, but he's got the Indy 500 win and he's got 6 championships in an era dominated with spec cars. To me, Scott Dixon will always forever, not even close, not even in the same sentence, is a much better driver than Elio Cashman of his all around. Now, I would take Elio at the Indy 500, but you're talking any other track, I'm taking Scott Dixon. And for that reason, that's why I would rather have that resume, because he is, without a doubt, one of the greatest drivers ever, no matter what track. And that's including Indy. I mean, he's no slouch at Indy. He just doesn't have some of those breaks go his way that lead to wins, unfortunately.
Okay, that's fair. I respect your take. I understand where you're coming from. I'm going to disagree, and I think we'll make this our Twitter poll when the episode releases and get the overall fan input side of things here. But I don't really have much of a rebuttal for you, if I'm being completely honest, because I didn't really think about that.
You can just call me moron if you want.
No, I'm not going to do that. That would be mean, and I'm in a good mood today. The race was good, and there's more race. There's Formula One this weekend, so there's a lot going on. I'm getting older this week, so.
Oh God.
Yeah, I know it's a sad. I think I'm going to be Elio's age this week. So
is it Medicare time, or are you not quite there yet?
Not quite there yet. So, oh, okay. And I remembered to mail out the Team Pit Lane t-shirts for your mom. So
you finally mailed something to my mom.
Yes, I did have in my defense, I did have to wait for the t-shirts to be printed. So this was not really my fault.
Okay.
Well, I cannot control when a business prints things, but shout out to Styled Aesthetic for printing the t-shirts.
All right. Well, there's a couple more things I want to get to here. So first one is just are you up for talking about Team Penske, or could you take it or leave it?
Let's do it.
All right. So Simon Pagenaud, where we heard all during the week, this guy's got the best race car to the Team Penske stable. He's going to make his way to the front and like all race. I'm like, he's still kind of like 12th-ish. And then all of a sudden, like nowhere, he's like top five. I'm like, how did that happen? And then he gets Pato on the last lap to take P3, which is pretty cool. So he did good. Power, we documented his, brake failure or whatever coming into the pits. He also lost control, had to be turned around, lost a couple laps. I was watching some of the onboard replays from the first lap today. It looked like a lot of understeer early because he was trying to just keep it out of the wall a couple times. Newgarden had a weird strategy going. I have no idea what was going on there, if I'm being honest. He was going for the undercut every stop, and then it just didn't work at the end. And I don't know if they were just trying to switch it up and go for the win or what, but it just didn't work. McLaughlin was actually having a pretty respectable race until he had his pit speeding penalty, and then was kind of relegated to a different strategy and ran out of gas, or was close to running out of gas on the last lap. Simona had a day to forget, kind of a learning experience for her and the team to move forward, but another one that had a pit issue, just not the best day for them all day, really. So Penske's now had kind of 2 years in a row where they've really struggled. What changes do they have to make to get back to the front next year at Indianapolis?
So let me start with the good first. We said, like you said, all week, doesn't matter about what Simon says about race pace because he's starting 26th. I take that back. Next, if Simon has a bad qualifying and he says that next year, I'm going to put money on him to finish in the top 10. I should have probably done that this year. But overall, Newgarden's strategy was perplexing because they went for the undercut about three pit stops in a row. And you do that because you think, okay, historically there's always a yellow. There's typically a yellow in the last 50 laps of the race or so. And that just didn't happen this year. So bad luck. Will Power, I mean, on the first sequence before the pit stop, he passed seven or eight guys and then had to restart from the rear of the field because, 10 other guys did, and I think that shuffled him towards the rear of the rear. But he was able to make up some positions and then just kind of never really recovered from there. McLaughlin was decent, having a good day. So I think whatever they do, whether it be in the off season or the first day of Indianapolis practice, 500 practice next year, they need to do maybe just a full day of, maybe the first day they need to, maybe they need to do more qualifying runs so they start better. Because if Simon Pagenaud started 15th instead of 26th, he probably would have been right up there in contention for a win much sooner than he was. So I'm going to say I think they need to figure out what they've been missing in qualifying for the last 2 years, because we 2 years in a row now that we don't have a Penske in the Fast Nine.
I think so, yeah. So I don't know. I think it's ever since the introduction of the aero screen, for one reason or another, it just hasn't worked for Team Penske. And as they said in the commentary, I mean, I know Chevy predominantly did not have the pace against Honda, but Ed Carpenter Racing did for whatever reason. So it's not like it's the engine, I don't think. I mean, I don't think the engine is necessarily helping them get to the front, but I also don't think it's the primary roadblock for them. So they definitely have some head scratching and soul searching to do for the next year, because it's hasn't been good ever since Roger bought the track. So that's kind of a weird one. I feel like we can't go through the episode without talking about Marco Andretti for at least 30 seconds. So what did you think of Marco's return and race on Sunday?
I don't think I heard his name mentioned once when the race started. So it was a pretty rough day for Marco. He was invisible. Yeah, and I don't mean that to be mean, but it was just totally a forgettable day.
One to forget. It's another one of those where it's just confusing, because you know they had a bunch of issues leading up to the qualifying, and then they feel like they figured it all out, so they feel pretty confident coming in the race, and it was just nowhere. I don't know what happened.
Yeah, he said he was way too trimmed out at the start of the race, and they kept trying to change the car and on the pit stops, and it wasn't working. And I feel like we've heard that for the last handful of years. Like a couple of years ago when he started maybe 10th, I think it was 2019 when he ran the Dayglow red/orange Mario Andretti tribute, and he plummeted and could barely hang on to the car and finish the race. I don't know what it is, but he seems like when he starts the car and it's not good, he can never recover no matter what they do in the pits throughout the day.
Okay. Last thing I wanted. Yeah, I completely agree. I just don't know what's going on there. But last thing I wanted to bring up before we recap some of our awful predictions. Did you get the sense, looking at some of the TV images and photos and stuff taken, that 40% capacity might have been a little generous? I mean, it obviously didn't look like Snake Pit was there or any of the infield seating was allowed on the non-permanent seats.
Yeah.
But you look at some of the shots of like the front straightaway in turn one, it looked like a normal race day, if you ask me.
Man, this is a hot topic in the Joakim household. I don't know what to think, because camera angles are very deceiving, and camera angles at racetracks are even more deceiving because they've found ways to hide empty seats at, you know, ovals like Texas and whatnot for years. So was there more than 135,000? I wouldn't be too surprised, but I don't know really what to think, because is it covered by camera angles? Maybe part. Is it more than 135,000? Probably a little bit, but yeah, I mean, it definitely, some of those TV angles, especially the ones that were like top down on the stands, you kind of look at those and you're like, did everybody else get the memo that it was only 40%?
Yeah, it was kind of it's one of the things I noticed right away. I'm like, holy cow, it looks full. So, yeah, I guess my big concern would be just, I don't know if Marion County is going to do an audit now and figure out if somehow IMS is not compliant and throw a bunch of suits at them or whatnot, or fine them or whatever. It was really great to just see the fans at the track though, and you know, to listen to the ovation that Elio got, or to see the reaction when Connor Daly took the lead for his first career laps led at that IMS was really awesome. So hope the fans stayed safe. Obviously, it's kind of a confusing one too, just with the rules set in place by federal government and then local governments and whatnot, they kind of conflict each other sometimes. You know, CDC says that if you're vaccinated and outdoors, that no masks are required, but then Marion County decides another thing, and then also they restrict it to 40%. It's kind of just like, honestly, it can confuse a lot of people out there for sure, just with the differing rules. But if you went to the race, I hope you had a fun time. If you've been vaccinated, I think that's the safest measure going forward to attend the races. So I don't think there's a whole lot to worry about there if you have been vaccinated. So I wonder what we'll see going forward. But like you said, Detroit and Road America are having their paddocks open, which is going to be awesome for the fans. And we'll see what the masks are required or anything like that going forward. But we will move on to our predictions here. Oh, sorry. Before we get to our predictions, we have to do the driver of the day and disappointment of the day. So who was your driver of the day?
Well, I'm going to take the obvious one here because I never take the obvious one here. Elio Castroneves entered legendary conversation with his fourth win. So hats off to him and the Meyer-Shank Racing team, our content partners for the year, which is pretty cool to have, you know, be partnered with the winning team in some way. So go Elio and go MSR.
Yes, they did good. I think another one for me is going to be Alex Palou. I think guy we haven't really talked about a whole lot in this episode, but can't take away anything he did in the race. And, you know, he's probably going to replay those last five laps in his head a lot, because I do think it could have played out a little differently if he had managed a little better. But again, the guy has been on a tear this year, and I think he's the only driver to lead a lap in every race so far. So he's continuing that good run. So that's good to see. Disappointment of the day?
Real quick, I want to give an honorable mention to Sage Karam, who we'll talk about on our predictions, but yeah, shout out to Sage. Disappointment of the day, I am going to go with Felix Rosenqvist. It's deceiving because he did lead 14 laps because he was way off strategy with Takuma Sato there, but he started 14th, had the pit lane speeding penalty, so he had a drive-through penalty on lap 81. But even before that, I know he started in the top 15, but I don't think he was top 15 contention at any point once the race started. And it's kind of continuing a scary trend for Felix this year where he just hasn't had a good result yet.
Yeah, it's an alarming one. Another one for me would be, in my prediction, or sorry, my answer is going to be James Hinchcliffe was just invisible all day. He's just had an invisible year. I don't think I heard his name mentioned once either. I just don't know what's going on, but something is not working there in that entry. And I don't know how much patience Michael's going to have, because the whole thing was, you know, Marco and Veach aren't doing well, so let's change some of the staff. Oh, they're still not doing well, so let's replace Veach and let's have Marco, you know, go down to part-time. And let's bring in Hinch and Herta, and we'll see if that helps. And obviously Herta's doing well, but Hinch, I just don't know. I don't know anymore. It's sad almost. So moving into our predictions, we had a winner prediction for the Indy 500. I had Graham Rahal. Really bummed about that one. I hope you're not allowed to give me any crap on that one. That one was looking real solid. But obviously ended up 32nd. Kanaan, 10th. He got really hosed early on with the stops and whatnot, and the recycling of the order. So I think a 10th for him is a pretty solid result given everything. Good prediction. I had Sage Karam. Thank you, Sage, for bailing me out. That was an awesome result. You did good. You making me look smart here. Really love that. Hope to see you at the track. Hope to see you at more races soon, because I think that is what we've been. That was must be such a satisfying result for him after a couple of tough years of driving Reinbold, and just one reason or another that program hasn't been really working on race day. But for 7th, that's kind of like the old Sage Karam that we were used to seeing up front. So that's awesome. You had Jack Harvey, 18th, but again, a really bad pit stop, a really another kind of self-inflicted mistake by that team. I think it's kind of funny too. I don't think the the 06 entry really put a foot wrong with pit stops all day. And they're the part-time, they're the part-time slash one-off guys. And then we got Harvey in the A-team squad with Meyer Shank, and they're continually making mistakes. So I don't know what's going on there.
Maybe some promotions coming.
Promotions and people getting put on waivers. I don't know what's going on here. Bad prediction. I had Elio. That's unfortunate. That's really unfortunate. And then you had Newgarden P12. I think it's bad by Penske standards. I don't know if it's bad in general, though.
Yeah, at least I win that one. I mean, I'm not winning these predictions overall. I'll say that, but yeah, these are easily my worst IndyCar predictions of the year as a group.
And then first out, I had Ed Jones at P28, and then you had Montoya at P9. So Stephen Wilson was the first one actually out. Jones was.
I don't know.
I can't remember if it was pole day or what, where Jimmy Vassar was talking about how they got a specific chassis number. I think it's chassis number 12 to match his car number that he won the kart championship with. And he's talking about Ed's been doing great this year. He just don't have the results to show for it, but we really like what he's doing for the team. And I'm just thinking to myself, like, what? What are you talking about? We're talking about the same guy. We're talking about Ed Jones.
If you're talking about another guy who was pretty much invisible on race day, it was Ed Jones. I mean, he plummeted through the field and finished either one lap or two laps down. I think just one lap down. And outside of being mentioned because he came out of pit lane kind of as the leaders were going by him, I don't think he was really talked about during the race.
No, he wasn't. And yeah, I don't know what the owners see, to be honest. I don't know if there's something else that we're missing, but I mean, Pietro Fittipaldi and
Grosjean.
Well, yeah, Grosjean and the Roden Street. Who does Coyne? Did Coyne have a third entry?
No.
They didn't, did they? See, there we go.
No,
oh,
the
I mean, they were going to maybe have.
Yeah.
Yeah, they were going to maybe have Cody Ware, but there again, another team that were, I think, a part time entry could have helped them, but. Like, it's good for Jones that there wasn't a third car. That could have been even worse. Yeah. Do we have anything else Indy 500 related to talk about? Is there anything else we missed?
I don't think so. I hope everybody enjoyed it. Watch the replays. And, yeah, let's look at the championship outlook here. And, yeah, I don't think there's anything else 500 related. I hope everybody enjoyed it. There were plenty of olds on Facebook who did not enjoy it, but I will just leave it at that. You can go on Facebook if you want. I don't want to. Yeah, Matt.
Oh, I forgot one thing that we didn't discuss was that I know the conditions were ideal for a race because it was a little cooler, but it seemed like the package that IndyCar worked on in the offseason did help. I know some of the recent Indy 500s haven't been as entertaining as some of the ones from yesteryear, but I definitely think this race was not only entertaining, but really gripping and had a good finish. So credit to Jay Fry and company, because I do think if we can help build on what we did this season for the Indy 500 for next year and kind of keep tweaking it, I do think this package can work, because that was a lot of fun.
Yeah, I think this was a huge step in the right direction aerodynamically to get these cars to where they need to be to put on a good race. So hats off to Jay Fry and the aerodynamic team, which I think is led by Tino Belli. I'm sorry, I'm probably butchering his name, but he's a great follow on LinkedIn if you want to learn more about IndyCar and aerodynamics of all social media platforms. But anyway, we'll wrap it up there, guys. Formula One this weekend. We'll do a live show for it. I think I will. Matt will be away for the weekend. I am hoping to make my at-track debut for the year at Road America. Fingers crossed. I don't know how many media they're allowing in, but now that the paddock is open to fans, I'm kind of hoping media restrictions ease a little bit. Time will tell on that one. I probably won't know until probably after we record next week, but fingers crossed I get to see some fine people in Road America, if not soon after that. I would love to be back at the racetrack this year. And I think that's it. Have a lovely weekend of racing, guys.
Today's podcast was presented by Podgo. Podgo is the easiest way for you to monetize your podcast, providing podcasters with a flat rate for ad space so you always know how much you get when you include an ad from Podgo. If you're a podcaster, you can apply too immediately and get connected with advertisers that fit your audience. Go to podgo.co at podgo.co and let them know that we sent you there.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.